Good afternoon, everyone. I would like to welcome you to the February 7th, 2013 Senate Committee on Healthcare and Human Services. Are there any committee measures to introduce?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay.
No, I have
not. All right. I would like to open a work session on Senate Bill 166. Committee Administrator, bring us up to date on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 166, you'll recall, came to us. We had a hearing on Monday the 4th, Tuesday the 5th. This is the bill that is reversing what the current practice between the insurers and the insureds are, where electronic communication will be the primary mode and the insured will have to sign up for regular mail that does not apply to notices of cancellation or non-renewal. There was a little bit of confusion about the language and the intent, if it actually did accomplish, so the parties went off and got an amendment. The amendment allows the insurers to send the notices electronically without complying with other governing statutes relating to electronic communications to consumers, as long as the insured is given the opportunity to select paper notices when applying for and renewing coverage. Madam Chair, we have the fiscal impact on the dash one and the dash two, and there is no fiscal or revenue impact.
Dash one.
I'm sorry, the dash ones.
Okay, don't confuse me, Sandy.
I know, I know. I apologize. Right. I had two statements, so I made it the dash two, but it's really the dash one.
Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 166.
Senator Cruz moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 166. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 166 as amended by the dash one amendment to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 166 as amended with the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Stanton Hayward.
Excused.
Senator Knope.
Aye.
Senator Steele.
Excused.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Motion carries and
you didn't vote.
Oh yes,
okay.
Aye. Motion carries. I'm in a hurry. And Senator Cruz, would you carry this bill? All right. With that, I would like to close the work session on Senate Bill 166 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 281. Sandy, would you give us an update on this bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 281 comes to you at the request of Senator Boquist. This bill is adding post-traumatic stress disorder to the definition of debilitating medical condition for the purposes of authorizing participants to be available to use the medical use of marijuana.
Great. To start this off, I'd like to bring up a panel of one, Todd Delotto from Corvallis. Todd Delotto from Corvallis, Leland Berger from Portland, and Brian Michaels from Eugene.
By the way, we just passed this one out, so guess we'll let it up.
Madam Chair and Committee, thank you so much for considering the addition of post-traumatic stress disorder to the list of qualitating medical conditions for the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act, and for taking it so seriously to consider it this early in the session and give this much hearing time to it. My name is Todd Delotto. I'm a horticultural scientist and public policy consultant specializing in medicinal cannabis at Can Research Education and Consulting in Corvallis. And living in rural Frolomith, I'm a constituent of Senator Boquist, who introduced Senate Bill 281 at my request. The Oregon Health Authority is charged by statute to adopt rules for evaluating petitions for particular diseases and conditions to be included among those that qualify as debilitating medical conditions under the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act. The Department of Human Services, which administered the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program from its inception in 1999 until 2009, promulgated the original set of rules to deal with this, which involved convening an expert panel to review the petition and make recommendations to the department regarding approval or denial. Minor changes have been made to these rules since the OMMP moved to the Oregon Health Authority in 2009. Unfortunately, these rules have proven to be inadequate for ensuring a fair review and decision-making process for the following reasons. There is a lack of protection against bias, prejudice, and conflict of interest in both the panel selection criteria as well as the decision to approve or deny petitions. There's a lack of requirement for the decision to be based upon scientific evidence. Meetings of the expert panel are not public meetings. And there's a lack of consideration for the effective federal ban on clinical research to the benefits of medical cannabis by the Drug Enforcement Agency, the FDA, and the National Institute of Drug Abuse, which all those strongly support only research into the potential harms of cannabis. So these serious flaws amounted to a review process that fails to ensure petitions to adding debilitating medical conditions would be reviewed fairly. This was manifest on both occasions in 2000 and 2009 when expert panels were convened to review petitions to add post-traumatic stress disorder among other psychiatric conditions. And hopefully Lee Berger will show up to illustrate what happened with that process. But basically, the composition of both seven-member panels included three advocates of medical cannabis, three unwavering opponents of cannabis, and the state public health officer who sided with the opponents, thus denying the petitions for all conditions except the one to add aggravated Alzheimer's disease.
So just clarify again. You said there were three for cannabis, three...
On the expert panel?
Yes.
Yeah, there were three advocates for cannabis, okay. For medical cannabis, three unwavering opponents, and then the state public health officer made up the fourth.
Okay. And,
thank you. Okay. In June of 2012, the Public Health Division was finally convinced that these flaws necessitated an overhaul of this review process. So thus, a Rules Advisory Committee was convened, which I was appointed to recommend changes to the Oregon Administrative Rules with the goals of establishing protections against bias, prejudice, and conflict of interest, to enhance the accountability and transparency. The first goal was not met at all. The second goal of accountability and transparency was partially met. The third goal was establishing clear criteria for the decision-making process. That was partially met. Establishing fair selection criteria of experts. That was partially met. And streamlining the process for greater efficiency and cost savings. That goal was clearly met. The Oregon Health Authority's Advisory Committee on Medical Marijuana, which I serve as chair, the Rules Advisory Committee, which I was appointed to, and most people who testified during the public comment period all strongly recommended that the above goals be met with this rule change. In the finalized text, as I noted earlier, the only one goal was fully met. Most were partially met, and the most important goal, to establish protections against bias, prejudice, and conflict of interest, was not met at all. Because the new rule will not ensure an objective review for future petitions to add debilitating medical conditions, and due to the bias that existed in the prior two petition processes, patients who suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder and other debilitating medical conditions still are unable to rely upon the administrative process to consider their condition fairly. Therefore, addition of debilitating medical conditions by statute is the only remaining way to ensure people suffering from medical conditions that are safely and effectively treated with medical cannabis can be protected for their use of medical cannabis. Following this group's testimony will be medical experts and those who suffer from PTSD to demonstrate both the safety and efficacy in treating PTSD with cannabis, as well as the urgency for adding PTSD to the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act's list of qualifying conditions. So I strongly urge you to please support Senate Bill 281 with a due pass recommendation so Oregon can become a place where returning combat vets and others suffering from horrible trauma can feel more safe and protected in our state. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. My name is Leland Berger. I'm a lawyer. My bar number is 830201. In April, I will be practicing for 30 years. Appearing today as a part of Compassionate Oregon. Compassionate Oregon is a political action committee that our community has formed to promote four bills, this being the first of the four. I also have represented folks both at the initial set of hearings and at the hearing specifically about PTSD and other psychiatric conditions. And if I were a legislator, I'd want to know why is this here? Why haven't you exhausted your administrative remedies? And the purpose of my testimony is pretty much to answer that question. And apologize for being late, and I hope it's not too redundant anything Mr. Delato shared with you. In November 1998, the Medical Marijuana Act passed, and I think just briefly, it's important to understand that the act doesn't say this is marijuana is good medicine for this or bad medicine for that. The Medical Marijuana Act says that, acknowledges that there were people who found relief from certain debilitating conditions based on their therapeutic use of medical cannabis. And the decision by the people acting as a coextensive branch of the legislature that those people ought not be within the ambit of the criminal law. Their use and cultivation and sharing and distribution within certain guidelines ought to be accepted from the criminal law. That's really what we're talking about when we're talking about the conditions that are involved based on the patient's physician diagnosing the condition and opining that, yeah, it might work actually, it might help for this condition. December 1998 was the effective date. In May 1999, the first registry cards were issued. In early 1999, there was a rules advisory committee that I sat on which suggested administrative rules, including a rule for adding new conditions. Between 1999 and 2000, about 20 petitions were filed, including for PTSD. Consolidated so-called hearings, and I say that because they lacked due process. They were held in secret. The secret evidence was heard. Nonetheless, that this committee held in 2000 with unanimous agreement that anxiety ought to be added to the list of debilitating medical conditions. In response, the program responded by limiting as much as they could by adding adult Alzheimer's. Specifically as to PTSD, it may be of interest to this committee. The 2000 advisory panel's vote was evenly divided, 4-4. Ultimately, I don't have the date, but I know the legislature codified adult Alzheimer's as an additional condition, and I know that it happened after Speaker Minnis was voted out of office and that it wasn't going to happen while she was the Speaker. On March 28, 2005, a registered nurse who worked as a psychiatric nurse named Edward Glick filed a petition to reconvene the advisory panel for the purpose of considering the inclusion of clinical depression, depressive symptoms, post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety, agitation, and insomnia to the list of the qualifying diseases or conditions. The petition was in the form of a report of a psychiatric benefit survey conducted by Nurse Glick at the Compassion Center in Eugene, Oregon, entitled Patients Report Mood and Emotional Benefits from Cannabis Use. And the way he was able to do a survey is that there already are patients who are protected by the Medical Marijuana Act who are using it for PTSD. They're just, quote, lucky enough to have a listed physical debilitating medical condition. Nurse Glick wrote, the results of the Compassion Center Psychiatric Benefit Survey support the finding that persistent psychiatric symptoms are being successfully treated by monitored use of herbal cannabis. Patients are reporting additional benefits they perceive as highly desirable, including reduced pharmaceutical use and improved functional ability. Consistency of reports lends credence to these reports. The research study represents the first attempt to quantify Oregon Medical Marijuana Program registrants' experience with herbal cannabis and supports a request to the Oregon Department of Human Services to reconvene the Debilitating Medical Conditions Advisory Panel. And then the conditions are the six that I mentioned. And what was significant and the reason that it had to go this way is that Nurse Glick claimed that this documentation constitutes new evidence in support of cannabis's psychiatric utility. Because it had previously been denied, there had to be new evidence for the department to consider it again. So the DHS treated this as Nurse Glick's petition, and by letter dated December 13, 2005, DHS's Dr. Grant Higginson summarily denied Petitioner Glick's petition. The cause and pretense of the denial was that the petition was frivolous. That was what authorized Higginson to deny Glick's petition. The letter constituted final DHS action, which entitled Nurse Glick to judicial review, either in the circuit court where he lived or in the Marion County Circuit Court. Nurse Glick filed a petition for review in the Benton County Circuit Court, where he lives, and Dr. Higginson offered to rescind the summary denial. Nurse Glick rejected this proposal because of how unfair DHS's procedures had been in 2000. We weren't going to accept hearings like the kinds of hearings they had in 2000. So in late June and early July of 2006, Anthony Johnson, who's now the executive director of the National Cannabis Coalition, and I met with an assistant attorney general named Leonie Reeves, who's now the governor's counsel, to negotiate a more fair hearing procedure. And that November, we submitted a proposed dismissal order, and the petition for judicial review was dismissed. On January 26, 2009, on Nurse Glick's behalf, I filed with the Advisory Committee on Medical Marijuana the renewed petition to add the six psychiatric conditions, including PTSD. Consistent with the administrative rule and consistent with Department of Human Services' request, on March 30, 2009, Nurse Glick filed a detailed explanation justifying inclusion of these conditions. Public hearings were held on July 27, August 13, and August 24, 2009, based on additional rules and conditions regarding the hearings that DHS announced to us the day before the first hearing as an ultimatum. This is how it's going to be. The rules permitted a retired professor named Dr. Donald Austin unlimited time presenting the panel with the results of his so-called structured literature review. Nurse Glick presented expert testimony, including from folks you'll be hearing later today, which was limited in time and scope, along with lay testimony in support of his petition. Additionally, at the request of the panel, two what I characterize as drugs are bad addiction experts testified. Regarding the panel, part of the agreement Nurse Glick reached with the Attorney General's office was to be allowed input onto who was on the panel. The panel, selected by Dr. Higginson, included three persons with knowledge of cannabis therapeutics, three persons without such knowledge, and Dr. Higginson. One of the prohibitionists, Diane Leah, was a social worker addiction specialist with DHS who offered as evidence at the hearing reports from the Office of National Drug Control Policy, which even Dr. Higginson recognized had no place at this hearing. Nurse Glick's objections to Ms. Leah being a part of the panel were rejected by the hearing facilitator and DHS, notwithstanding her obvious bias. Predictably, the three persons without training or experience in cannabis therapeutics voted against adding any of the conditions. Two of the three with cannabis training voted for adding all, and the third voted for adding all except for clinical depression. Dr. Higginson, because the decision defaulted to him because of the way he created the committee, suggested that the OMMP consider initiating a legislative concept for the 2011 session to allow research on medical marijuana for PTSD in well-controlled situations. No action was ever taken on this, of course. The final report was issued by facilitator Jana Fussell on October 20, 2009. Nurse Glick filed a rebuttal on October 30, 2009. On March 3, 2010, Dr. Cohn issued a notice of intent to deny. Nurse Glick sought reconsideration on March 24, 2010 and requested a hearing. Last page. On April 5, 2010, DHS referred the request to the Office of Administrative Hearings, who appointed Administrative Law Judge Gary Meerdink to decide the matter. On July 27, 2010, ALJ Meerdink decided he had jurisdiction to hear the matter, and he ruled that the scope of the hearing was limited to whether DHS abused its discretion in denying the petition. That's how come they issued a notice of intent to deny, because then not only were we denied the right to go to court and present the evidence de novo, over again and new to let the judge decide, but instead an administrative law judge was limited to deciding whether DHS denied their abused their discretion. If it's within the discretion and there's any evidence to support it, the ALJ has to affirm the decision. And on January 7, 2011, ALJ Meerdink allowed DHS's motion for summary determination. On April 12, 2011, Dr. Cohn issued a final order denying Nurse Glick's petition. Now, Nurse Glick had the right to appeal this decision to the Court of Appeals, but he chose not to do so because it would have been futile. Because, you know, again, the Court of Appeals would be deciding whether the ALJ erred by deciding that the DHS didn't abuse their discretion. So, all of this is to say two things. First of all, actually, I want to say a thing before I tell you the two things. I want to let you know that Ed Glick didn't receive any remuneration for his work on this. I didn't receive any remuneration for my work on this. Nobody who's testifying before you is being paid to testify before you today. This is truly a grassroots citizen effort. The two things I wanted to make sure you were clear about is, first, we have exhausted all other remedies other than a legislative solution, either in this building or through the initiative process, having the people act as a co-equal branch of the legislature. And this, today, is Nurse Glick's opportunity for a full and fair hearing before neutral and fair decision makers. And we appreciate your holding this hearing today. On Nurse Glick's behalf, and on behalf of all Oregonians using cannabis therapeutically to treat their post-traumatic stress who don't otherwise qualify the protection of the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act, especially, but not only, combat veterans, returning combat veterans, I respectfully request the committee return Senate Bill 281 to President Courtney with a due pass recommendation. I'd be glad to answer any questions that you have, but that's what I wanted to tell you
today. Let's finish the panel first, and then...
Thank you, Chair Modest Anderson.
Good afternoon. My name is Brian Michaels. I'm an attorney in Eugene, and I've represented a lot of people involved in marijuana through or not through the Medical Marijuana Act. Yesterday, you may have received, or I was told you did receive, a copy of an article that was published in the Register Guard that was written by myself and Dr. Alan Cohn. Dr. Alan Cohn was recently retired after 35 years as the psychiatric medical doctor supervising the Lane County Adult Corrections. And his experience with PTSD is identified in the article that was written, and I'll read a short passage from that in a minute. If it needs to be said, let's say it. PTSD is an identifiable medical diagnosis with identifiable medical symptoms. It is not something someone says, oh, I was in a car accident, or the military was terrible, therefore I have PTSD. This is an actual scientific medical diagnosis. And some of the symptoms, not all of them, are mentioned in the article that you received. And this is what Dr. Cohn wrote in the article that we authored back in October 4th of the past year. In the 35 years he has provided services to Lane County Adult Corrections, he reports that many patients support the fact that medical marijuana helps people suffering from PTSD to remain in the community, often leading productive and high-functioning lives. However, when the source of people's medicine is removed, or they are legally prohibited from using it, increased PTSD symptoms result in behavioral and emotional instability, which frequently results in a return to jail. Families confirm this sad and unnecessary outcome. One of the problems that was discussed by the two speakers before me was the administrative rules promulgated by the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program regarding the addition of nuclear pating conditions. I won't repeat or go over with great length about what that was, but suffice it to say, our previous Attorney General had a tenure of open hostility toward this piece of legislation and to the agency that was in charge of administering that. And over the years, as a member of the Advisory Committee to the Medical Marijuana Act, which I have been for years, I have identified and written to the Attorney General and to the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program a series of administrative rules and other decisions directing the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program to act in ways that are contrary, if not actually hostile, to the legislation this Attorney General was hired to support. But we're here to talk about this one particular PTSD because it is so severe and it is so universal. When I say universal, I say this. When we talk about the wars in Afghanistan or Iraq, we may have differences of opinion. When we talk about supporting the troops who went to fight on our behalf, there is little difference of opinion. Democrat, Republican, pro-war, anti-war, we all say we are in support of the troops. We support our troops. We give them our thanks. no matter what our political views may be. Now, these people are coming home with severe, severe debilitating issues. Their families, they can't feel familiar and comfortable around their families. They can't hold jobs. They're antisocial. They're sometimes often violent for no reason. They are unstable. And I will say to you that any one of us in that position would do what they can to eliminate those symptoms. The treatments available for identifiable, diagnosed PTSD are highly ineffective. There is no doubt about that. Now, you may call it unscientific, and you may call it anecdotal, but I'm telling you, if you're a Vietnam veteran who comes home with this kind of symptom, and someone offers you marijuana, you are going to use it, because it alleviates these symptoms. There's just no question about it. The life you have without it is so horrible. You will risk whatever criminal consequences may come on down the road. It's that simple. So when you examine this particular piece of legislation, there's the other side of the mirror, which is you're not adding a group of people who will use marijuana, because they're going to use it anyway. What you're doing is you're subtracting a group of Oregonians, veterans, from the list of people who will have their doors broken down, their children stolen, their property seized, their family torn asunder, and who may indeed go to jail for taking this medicine. Again, you are not adding people who can use marijuana, because they're already using it in large numbers. They have to. They don't have much of a choice. You're eliminating from the list of people whose doors get broken down, whose homes get raided, whose property gets seized, whose children get stolen, and whose lives get torn asunder. If you look at it from that perspective, it's really a no-brainer. Why would you subject these veterans, to whom we all agree we support, to this type of consequence? There is no reason. If we support our troops, that's what we do. We support our troops, and we say to them, we support you, and here's the way we're going to do it. Because we recognize that you need this in order to survive after what you did for us. I don't really have much more.
Okay. What I should have said this at the very beginning. This bill is going to two committees. It came to us, the Health Committee, because we need to look at the medical component of it. That's what we want. We needed to know, though, the process of what you've been through so far. So that's good. But we will be looking at the actual need for it. We're lay people, but we need to hear the testimony from the people who really feel that this is the right thing. It's nice to know that it did not work, but then it will go to judiciary that will look at the legal ramification of it. So I just want to let you all know that up front.
Okay. Could I respond to that just briefly?
Mm-hmm.
Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, a couple of things. First of all, there's a good body of literature, scientific literature, supporting the use of cannabis for post-traumatic stress, and most recently from Israel. There's a scientific literature on it.
Could you reference that and get it to the committee administrator to then disseminate to us?
The literature?
The actual research?
It's in the article that me and Dr. Cohn wrote. We discussed the, because as we put it in the article.
Oh, in here. Is it in here?
No, it's an article.
Mr. Michaels is referencing the article that was published in the.
And Dr. Cohn wrote, which I was told was distributed to you yesterday. I have hard copies for each of you if you want.
Oh, let's.
Mr. Taylor, who's the lobbyist for Compassionate Oregon, had distributed a packet of materials. The Register Guard article that Mr. Michaels is referencing, I think, is in there. I can certainly provide the committee with Nurse Glick's literature that he provided in 2009, and it's quite voluminous, Chair Monis-Anderson. I mean, the department put it on a CD. Frankly, it's that voluminous. Additionally, some of it, frankly, is, as Mr. Michaels suggests, anecdotal, and I wanted to speak briefly to that. I'm, you know, 57 years old, and a couple of years ago, I started taking baby aspirin because my doctor kept insisting I do it. And I found out that the reason why he did that is because a doctor in Southern California found that, anecdotally, his patients, when they were using aspirin, that it thinned their blood, and so that it helped prevent heart attacks, he deduced from that, and now it's common medical practice. So I know that sometimes, in evaluating the medical efficacy of things, people look at anecdotal evidence with askance. The other issue, of course, is that there's a dearth of human trial evidence in the United States because it's been the policy of the federal government, first of all, to deny permits for cultivating medical-grade cannabis to do the testing, and secondly, and more importantly, the people who decide that you can do that are NIDA, the National Institute of Drug Abuse, and when you apply for a grant to do a study, the hypothesis has to be the harm that marijuana causes. So, So in reviewing the literature, I just ask that you keep those two things in mind. And I neglected at the beginning to share what I always share when I come to the legislature, which is that I live in inner northeast Portland in Senator Shields and Representative Frederick's district.
As I quickly go over this article, basically it does say that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration recognized research from the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies to evaluate whether smoked or vaporized marijuana might help reduce PTSD symptoms in 50 veterans diagnosed. And so at least this research was done on 50 veterans.
I can get you the MAP study. That's not a problem.
Okay.
If I may, Madam Chair, the following group consists of five physicians, some of which are some of the nation's top medical researchers.
Yes. Okay.
Yes.
All right. Questions at this point in time, because we have 2 pages worth of people who want to testify.
I will hold my fire, but thank you very much for being here.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. The second panel, I would like to call Dr. Lester Grinspoon from Boston, Massachusetts, Dr. Frank Lucido from Berkeley, California, and Dr. Susan Sisley from Phoenix, Arizona, where my daughter, grandson, and son-in-law live.
And they're on the phone.
And on the phone?
No, they are on the phone.
Oh, they're all on the phone. Are you all on the phone?
This is Dr. Grinspoon. I'm on the phone.
Would you like them all on the phone at the same time?
Yep. Got it. So let's have...
Okay.
Go ahead and start.
Well, Dr. Grinspoon, would you please begin?
Yes, I'll be glad to.
Go ahead.
And Emeritus Professor... psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School. I have been studying marijuana since 1967. I began my studies because I was so concerned that it was a harmful drug and that young people just weren't paying attention to the government or other organizations who were asserting its harmfulness. I was, to make a very long story brief, I was taken by surprise when I got into the Conway Library, the library at Harvard Medical School, for those couple of months, and reviewed it the first, in a more superficial way, the first time. I went back and spent more than a year reviewing it for a book I wrote on the subject. But I was absolutely astonished to discover how abysmally ignorant I had been about this drug. I had assumed that what I was learning, largely from the U.S. government, that it was a very harmful drug. I discovered that there was very little in any inherent psychopharmacological property of the drug which was nearly as harmful as the fact that we were arresting at that time about 300,000, mostly young people, almost 90% for just mere possession. I should tell you that since that time, that figure has gone up. And in 2011, in this country, 856,000 people, mostly young people, almost 90% for just possession, were arrested in this country. And we have arrested more than 23 million people since this prohibition began. Now, about, you know, in 1993, I published a book. I had been looking at the question of medical marijuana. I hadn't emphasized medical marijuana in that first book, which was published by Harvard University Press in 1971. It was called Marijuana Reconsidered, although there was a chapter on what was largely 19th century and early, in the spilling over into the early decades of the 20th century, use of an alcoholic solution of cannabis known as cannabis indica. But once it was virtually prohibited to doctors as a result of the 1937 Marijuana Tax Act, the first of the draconian legislation aimed at marijuana, it fell out of the pharmacopoeia in 1942. And since then, physicians have become ignorant about this important medicine. I had a family experience that motivated me to dig deeply into the question of its usefulness as a medicine. And in 1993, James B. Bacalar and I published Marijuana, the Forbidden Medicine, published by Yale University Press. And so we were learning so much about it that by 1997, 4 years later, we wrote a new edition of it, and it was just about twice as long as the first edition because so much more had been learned about it. Now, one of the things I learned about cannabis, largely from people who had served in Vietnam, was that it was a very useful drug in the symptomatic treatment of PTSD. I should tell you at the outset, I mentioned it briefly, but the fact of the matter is that marijuana is a remarkably non-toxic medicine. There has never been a death anywhere in the world from overdose of marijuana. One can't say that about any other drug that I know of. When it becomes accepted in the U.S. pharmacopoeia, it will be seen as one of the least harmful drugs, the least toxic drug in that compendium. It's not only useful, very useful, for people with PTSD, but it is, among other things, the cheapest and the most effective medicine. It's much more effective than anything that the pharmaceutical industry can produce. And of course, even at street prices, it's less expensive. So I think that it is a big mistake to deprive people who suffer from this distressing disorder a medicine which is very, very useful, remarkably non-toxic to them, and very inexpensive. It is, in my view, the medicine of choice. Now, you know, it won't cure PTSD. There isn't much that does that I know of. There have been some studies, and I first wrote a paper on that I thought years ago that I thought MDMA methylene dioxymethamphetamine, which is referred to on the street as ecstasy, might be useful in this, but it would be useful in the context of an ongoing psychotherapeutic experience. And these studies are being done as we talk, and the early results suggest that may turn out to be so, that it may turn out to be something which can not only treat it, but actually move it, hopefully remove it. One can't say that about marijuana, and that's unfortunate, but there are many disorders for which we have no cure, but we can provide good solutions to the symptomatology often. And in my view, cannabis is one of those drugs, the best one in the treatment of PTSD.
Thank you, Dr. Greenspoon. And I missed, what type of doctor are you?
I'm a professor of psychiatry.
Psychiatry. Thank you very much.
Emeritus. I'm retired now.
Yes. Okay. Thank you very much. Any questions for him? All right. Dr. Frank Lucido, are you on the line?
I am.
Did I
Can you hear me?
Yes. Loud and clear.
Great. Well, I'm a family practice doctor in Berkeley, California since 1979. And I continue to do that after 33 years. And for the last 16 years, I've also been seeing medical cannabis patients. And I've probably seen close to 100 patients with PTSD. At least a third of those, I think, are vets. I didn't keep a separate tally of how many are vets. But
say your name for the record. You said who you were.
Sure, yeah. Frank Henry Lucido, L-U-C-I-D-O.
Thank you.
And I went to the University of Michigan for undergraduate and medical school and did my residency in family practice through UC Davis.
Thank you. Okay, proceed.
Okay, so as I mentioned, I've seen something like 100 patients with PTSD, probably a third to maybe one half of those are vets. Plus, I had the experience of my mother having PTSD from being growing up in Rome and being there when it was invaded and occupied by the Germans, and so she had her share of PTSD. So what I found is the Vietnam vets have the ones that have shown me that in many cases cannabis is the one medicine that's consistently helped their seriously disabling symptoms, allowing them to function, hold jobs, keep their relationships intact, raise families for the past 30 years or so when years of therapy and numerous medications have not. We found that cannabis has helped replace antipsychotics, antidepressants, anti-anxiety medicines, sleeping pills, and alcohol for many of these very sick veterans and others with PTSD. And so it's been very gratifying to see the change that a lot of these veterans and others have had. One of the side effects of cannabis, as you may have heard, is people don't remember their dreams. And I found that when people have nightmares from the PTSD, this is really a blessing rather than a side effect. I think that's the main points I wanted to get, but like I said, my experience has been for the last 16 years since California passed their law.
Thank you very much. It's really important for us to hear from the medical community on this issue. Are there questions for Dr. Lucido? Thank you very much, Dr. Lucido.
Well, thank you.
All right, Dr. Susan Sisley from Phoenix, Arizona, are you on the line?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Excellent. Please say your name.
I'll go ahead. My name is Sue Sisley. Last name is S-I-S-L-E-Y. I'm an MD. I practice internal medicine and psychiatry, and I'm a professor at the University of Arizona College of Medicine. and I was asked to address you guys today about a study that we have approved, that's been approved for almost 2 years now by the FDA, and has also been approved by our university's IRB. So the U of A Institutional Review Board approved this marijuana study that would look at the safety and efficacy of using medical marijuana in combat veterans who have treatment-resistant post-traumatic stress disorder. And I think that the reason I was asked to talk with you about this study is because, sadly, as important as this study is, and it was hailed by the FDA as a real triumph, sadly, it has not been allowed to be implemented due to this, what we refer to as the NIDA monopoly. The National Institute on Drug Abuse has essentially a government-enforced monopoly where they are the only legal supply of research marijuana in the country.
Say that again.
If NIDA chooses not to sell a group of investigators study drug for their research, then the study will not be able to be, will not move forward, because if a study is FDA approved, that's the only legal supply is through NIDA. So it's a really unusual situation because marijuana is the only Schedule I drug that has this type of government, of this sort of second review by NIDA. There's no other Schedule I drug that is forced to do this. So we have, you know, if we do a study on LSD or MDMA or any other Schedule I drug, once we get FDA approval, we simply move forward to implement the study. But with marijuana, you can't do that. And so the study has been mired and, you know, it's essentially being stonewalled by in what looks to be a permanent review process. You know, NIDA is not does not favor studies that use the term efficacy in the title of the study. So if we were doing a study of marijuana looking at the harmful side effects of marijuana or the dangerous abuse potential of marijuana, that study would not only get green-lighted by NIDA, but it would probably receive tons of government funding and have no problem moving forward. But we dared to say that we wanted to look at the efficacy of marijuana in treating human subjects who have PTSD, and that's where this study and other studies around the country are getting stonewalled. And it's important for you guys to be aware of this, because what's happened is, you know, when we look at adding PTSD as a qualifying diagnosis for medical marijuana programs around the country, the problem is that there's no published data from any randomized controlled trials because of this NIDA monopoly, because of this bottleneck at NIDA. So at present, there's no published data looking at the risks and benefits of marijuana for subjects who have chronic PTSD. Our study is the only study of which we are aware that would attempt to conduct this process on human subjects. And it has been, and it is, as I mentioned, the fact that the U of A, you know, my university has some of the most rigorous standards for scientific research in the country, and their institutional review board scrutinized this research design intensively for months, and still, and ultimately gave us approval and felt that it was a very important study that needed to be conducted. And so much so that they have submitted a bill to our legislature, which is currently being reviewed right now and is very likely to pass, that would enable marijuana research to return to campus, because they want to provide a home for this study. They feel it's that important. So what happened was last year marijuana was banned from our university campuses, and the FDA-approved marijuana research was also banned from campus, not realizing that was sort of an unintended consequence of the ban. So the bill would move to bring the research back to the university. But anyway, I just wanted to share that with you. I think that a lot of people think that the FDA is the main blockade to doing marijuana research. It's actually not true at all. They've been partners and collaborators in marijuana. They see marijuana as a really valuable tool that should be part of our armamentarium, and they just want it to go through the proper drug development process that any other drug does is required to go through. And we all want that in the medical community, but we're not being allowed to move forward with that.
Now, was any research done yet in Arizona?
No, we're just waiting for NIDA. And what's interesting, many people don't know that, you know, when I send a study design to the FDA, they're required to respond in 30 days. They have a 30-day timetable. NIDA has no such timetable, so they can take 10 months or 10 years to respond to a study. And that's the way they keep studies that they don't like. They can keep them at bay forever. We had a vaporizer study 7 years ago where we asked, that was approved by the FDA. We asked NIDA to sell us a small amount of marijuana for a study drug. And that was 7 years ago. We're still waiting for a positive, you know, an affirmative response from them.
Thank you very, very much, Dr. Sisley. Are there questions? All right. Well, you're welcome to stay on the line to listen to the rest of the testimony, but I think that there's no one else on the line, correct?
Well, no.
Do we have
Doctor? I'm on the line, Brian Crum.
Oh, yes. Brian Crum from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Brian Crum. I'm a psychiatric nurse practitioner at Sage Neuroscience Center in Albuquerque. I thought there was one other person in front of me, though. Is it okay for me to start?
Yes, please.
Okay. As I said, I'm a psychiatric nurse practitioner at Sage Neuroscience Center in Albuquerque. I helped draft the medical cannabis law here in New Mexico, and I also included language that allows advanced practice nurses to refer patients to the program. It's something you might actually want to consider with your program there in Oregon, since there are many patients who are not able to access a physician, and a lot of primary care is conducted by advanced practice nurses. I currently manage close to 1,000 patients for PTSD in our medical cannabis program, and cannabis is proving to be the safest and most effective medication available for treating PTSD. The only FDA-approved medications for PTSD right now are Paxil and Zoloft. These are highly ineffective, and they often lead to worsening depression and anxiety, in some cases even suicidality. Everything else that we do pharmacologically for treatment of PTSD is off-label. We have failed to find any medications at this point that provide consistent benefits. It's all pretty much a crapshoot for us. And pharmaceuticals often pose serious adverse effects for patients. We have recent neuroimaging studies that have helped us unlock many of the mysteries underlying the neurobiological processes involved in PTSD. I did send a copy of a paper that I have written to all the members of the committee. I emailed that up, entitled Cannabis and Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, the Neurobiological Approach to Treatment. And it outlines the neurobiological processes involved in PTSD and also the role of the endocannabinoid system in managing those. The endocannabinoid system regulates virtually every process involved in the etiology of PTSD. Cannabis addresses the underlying neurobiological processes directly and alleviates core symptoms of PTSD with few clinically significant adverse effects. One of the big problems we see with PTSD is that we have a high rate of suicide associated with it, and that is true in Oregon as well. I pulled up a report from the Oregon Health Authority, the Public Health Division, titled Suicides in Oregon, Trends and Risk Factors, 2012 report. And this shows that in Oregon, suicide is the second leading cause of death among Oregonians age 15 to 34, and it's the eighth leading cause of death overall in Oregon as of 2010. Men are more than 3.5 times more likely to die by suicide than women, and approximately 26% of all suicides in Oregon are among veterans. 70% of suicide victims in Oregon had a diagnosed mental disorder, alcohol, and or substance abuse problems, or a depressed mood at the time of death. Unfortunately, less than a third of male victims and only about 60% of female victims actually were receiving any type of treatment for mental health problems at the time of death. In my own clinical experience, I have found that quite often patients lose trust in the psychiatric system. Many patients have been involved, they've tried to get help, and they have failed multiple medication trials, or they have serious adverse effects, and they lose faith in the psychiatric community. I have patients who have witnessed family members undergo psychiatric treatment with more and more medication being piled on and watching their family members continual decompensation unto death, and just some people just fear getting involved with the psychiatric community because of these failures. Another big problem that we have is alcohol use with PTSD. And toxicology reports from Oregon show that over 40% of tested cases, or actually, I'm sorry, a third of cases in Oregon test positive for alcohol, and more than 40% test positive for opiates and benzodiazepines. In my clinical experience, I find that the majority of patients who come in for treatment of PTSD who have alcohol abuse problems are able to dramatically reduce consumption of alcohol. In many cases, they're able to stop using alcohol altogether. Also, I see that many patients are able to decrease or stop the use of benzodiazepines, and even patients with chronic pain issues are often able to decrease the use and in some cases stop opioid medications altogether. We actually see that there is a dysfunction in the endocannabinoid system that is involved in the etiology of suicidal behavior. The 1950s ushered in the heyday of modern psychiatry and psychopharmacology. Prior to the 1950s, we still relied on shock therapy, and ice pick lobotomies were quite common. Then, while scientists were trying to alter antihistamines, they accidentally stumbled on the first phenothiazine antipsychotic medication. This revolutionized psychopharmacology. Soon, they tweaked these early tricyclics or phenothiazines, and they came up with the tricyclic antidepressants. Now we had a pill that we could give on a daily basis to help with psychosis. We had pills to help with depression, pills to help with anxiety. Unfortunately, psychopharmacology has advanced very little since the 1950s. We do have newer medications that are safer and may have fewer significant side effects, but the clinical outcomes have not significantly improved. We still turn to electroconvulsive treatment for treatment-resistant depression, and in severe cases, we even turn back to psychosurgery, a safer version of the ice pick lobotomy, and it's an accepted treatment option for some patients. Targeting the endocannabinoid system offers us the most significant advance in psychopharmacology since the 1950s. PTSD is a very complex disorder. It involves multiple areas of the brain and other organs. And once again, I would refer you back to the paper that's pending publication that I sent to you to really take a more in-depth look at some of these problems that happen. But because of the broad range of symptoms that we see in PTSD, it's very difficult to treat with a single medication. Pharmaceuticals, they develop to be very specific in their mechanism of action, and because PTSD is not a specific disorder, we have so many different areas of the brain and so many different systems that play a role. We often need to turn to drug cocktails, multiple medications that often cause significant adverse effects. Cannabis addresses symptoms across all three major symptom clusters in PTSD, and it does so with few clinically significant adverse effects. To conclude, I'd just like to say that cannabis is a safe and effective medication for treatment of PTSD, even when we have other co-occurring psychiatric disorders. Rather than just targeting the neurotransmitter systems and their agonists the way that we do with current psychopharmacological agents, cannabinoids target the underlying neurobiological processes that lead to imbalances in these neurotransmitter systems, and it helps to return these systems to a state of homeostasis. These state programs that we have for medical cannabis, even though we have not been able to get the actual clinical trials approved, these state programs act as large-scale trials of cannabis. As I said, I'm managing over somewhere around 1,000 patients right now. I have seen very few clinically significant adverse effects. I have had fewer than 2% of the patients who enroll under this program who withdraw because of problems with adverse effects, and it has proven to be the most consistently beneficial and also the best tolerated of any medication available for treating PTSD. Are there any questions that anybody has?
Yes. This is Senator Lori Montes Anderson. I would like to know, since you have so many patients, 1,000 with post-traumatic stress, anecdotally, or do you follow, suicides among that group? Any outcomes that you may have from, diagnosis versus non-diagnosis?
Yeah.
I mean, treatment versus non-treatment.
Keep statistics on that, but I follow very closely with my patients, and I monitor for suicidality at every visit. For some patients who have come in with chronic suicidality that has failed to remit with any other medications, cannabis is the only medication they found that actually decreases suicidality. I've had patients who have reported remissions of suicidality now for years with the use of cannabis, who suffered from chronic suicidality prior to that. For many patients, they find that if they are noticing suicidality starting to come up, cannabis is a very effective way to rapidly alleviate those symptoms, tones down the anxiety. One of the things that we see with PTSD is we get elevations in our stress axis, also called the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. And when this system starts cranking up, we start getting elevations in glucocorticoids, like cortisol and adrenaline, that pump up to the brain. And that puts people into a fight-or-flight mode. In PTSD, that does not turn off. And because of that constant hyperarousal, we actually can see reductions in a part of the brain called the hippocampus. We see reductions in hippocampal volume can be related to suicidal behavior. And I have seen cannabis be very effective at addressing suicidal thoughts in the patients that I treat.
Great. Any other questions? Thank you very much, Dr. Crown. And I believe you're the last.
I'm a nurse practitioner, not a doctor.
Sorry, that's right. I'm a nurse, and we just passed some legislation for nurse practitioners here. So thank you very much, Brian. And I believe that those are the only ones that we have on the phone. Yes. All right, thank you. And then Dr. Stegenborg, MD from Coos Bay.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chairwoman, and members of the committee. You want me to repeat my name? Richard Stegenborg, Stegenborg. That's MD. I'm a former VA psychiatrist, and I worked with well over 1,000 veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder. They constituted the overwhelming majority of the patients that I worked with. These are people who saw combat or were subjected to military sexual trauma or other severe stressors in the course of their military service. And one thing I learned from working with these folks is that they won't lie to you, because trust is a huge issue for people with PTSD. One of the main reasons that combat trauma is so bad is because these people frequently they feel a violation of trust, and they're very anxious around other people. It's very hard to form a relationship, and the one way you can blow that relationship is if you're not honest with them. It's a two-way street. The reason I bring that up is because since we have to base so much of this decision-making on anecdotal evidence, I hope you'll consider the fact that the veterans that I worked with are highly trustworthy. And they would come in and they would tell me the truth if I'd asked them if they were using marijuana, but they would often ask me not to write it down because of the stigma associated with it and the chance that they wouldn't be treated properly by other veterans, by other doctors, especially in terms of their pain symptoms. which are very common in combat veterans. About 50% of the people seen at the VA have pain complaints. About 30% have PTSD, so there's a huge overlap. And as Nurse Crum said, there's overlap with other conditions too, such as major depression, which shares part of the pathophysiology of PTSD with the chronically elevated cortisol stress hormones, creating some of the same effects, and with the alcohol abuse in particular. And as he said, there's some cross-benefit for all these conditions, which are all common in PTSD, for the, some of the same reasons he said. Primarily, let me qualify one statement that Dr. Sisley made. She said that there are no human studies. There are many human studies, but there, what she, I think she meant to say was that without research-grade marijuana, it's hard to compare them. And they're typically not controlled studies because it is hard to get IRB approval to use an illegal drug in a study. Even if you can get FDA approval, and then FDA says you have to go use this unattainable form of marijuana. So, but there are studies, and most of them are naturalistic. Most of them are small studies. The ones that are more controlled are outside the country, like the Israeli study that was mentioned earlier. And what they do show consistently is improvement in some key symptoms, which including sleep, nightmares, and anxiety. So that's well established. All the studies of any sort that have looked at these things have found that, that there's benefit there. And those are huge. I mean, really, probably the most common complaint that I get from my patients is they can't sleep. And they're up constantly thinking of terrible things that happened to them. These things, excuse me, got some bad memories myself. These things come up at night when they're trying to go to sleep. And that's why they have the nightmares. So they wake up feeling depressed because they've been reliving these experiences. And the veterans that told me they were using marijuana, whether it's medical marijuana or not, consistently said that helped with the anxiety, with the sleep, and often, not always, with the mood disturbance. And I had a number of patients who told me, and this is also documented in the literature and case reports and small studies, that it's been effective in getting people with alcohol abuse problems not to abuse because well, as Nurse Crum said, the receptor for cannabinoids is found throughout the brain. It has a very diffuse effect, calming effect. And one of the more important lines of research that's going on right now, most of the research is animal research, by the way. That's how we know a lot of this stuff. But one of the most important lines of research that's going on right now is looking at extinction of these traumatic memories. These are highly associated with suicidal thoughts and behaviors. And I did cite studies, by the way, for where they're available. And I believe you did get a package electronically. If you haven't got it, we'll make sure you did with all these studies. But that's really important because one of the main reasons PTSD is chronic is because these memories are learned in a different way than normal memories. They're basically imprinted on a part of your brain that's stimulated when you're in a highly aroused state. It's called the amygdala. That particular organ appears to be where these memories are actually stored, not only formed but stored. And the particular thing about this is when you forget something, it's a matter of getting a certain pattern of neurons to stop firing in response to something. When the amygdala stores a memory, that's very hard. It will continue to fire every time you're reminded, even of things that vaguely remind you of the original trauma. So they have these terrible memories. It makes it hard to go out and be around people. Things startle them. Things get them aroused. They get aroused. They have these memories. They have flashbacks, which have also been reported to be improved with use of marijuana. So there are a lot of benefits, and the evidence is as good as you can possibly expect. And I think that all of this evidence should be considered, including the anecdotal evidence, and particularly the anecdotal evidence of the veterans that I've worked with. Just want to make a few other points. I want to reinforce the fact that as a VA psychiatrist, I can tell you that everything you heard about medications for PTSD here is true. The drug companies sponsor most of that research, and of course they publish the positive results. They've been actually convicted many times of burying research and falsifying research. And I can tell you that the results for antidepressants, which are the only indicated medication for PTSD, are very poor. Nothing like the initial reports, and even the drug industry and the American Psychiatric Association are recognizing that those early reports of efficacy were grossly overstated. So there's really a dearth of treatments, and we need to consider every possible treatment. We owe these veterans everything. Benzodiazepines, in terms of antidepressants, aside from lack of efficacy, they say, well, don't worry about it. At least there's very few side effects. Let me just tell you a few of them. And this explains why there's a 20% dropout rate among veterans who are even willing to try these, and a lot aren't. There's a 20% dropout rate because they have decreased libido. They can have impotence. They can have sleep and appetite changes, either too much sleep or not enough sleep. They can become agitated. They can even become suicidal. And in a lot of these recent high-profile murders and mass murders that you've been reading about, there's speculation that one of the causes is antidepressant use, which is present in most of those cases. We've known this for some time. There's a black box warning on antidepressants. People don't tend to take it seriously. They warn patients about it, and that's it. And frequently, patients forget that, if they even get the warning. Get agitated and act impulsively. That's one of the characteristics of PTSD. You can become impulsive because you're so on edge. And, well, I don't want to go into PTSD too much, but soldiers are also trained to react without thinking when they're in a combat situation. If they feel they're in a combat situation because their PTSD has kicked in, that's one reason you see so much violence against self and others among veterans. Just a couple other comments about some of the other alternatives. People talk about benzodiazepines. First of all, they're not recommended for long-term use, particularly for sleep. There's no evidence that they're effective long-term. I've had many patients tell me that they quit taking their benzodiazepines when they started using marijuana because it worked better and it didn't have the same side effects. It's generally well tolerated, but there are side effects, including obviously morning and early morning sedation. And another comment: also, antipsychotics are being commonly used. The newer antipsychotics are supposed to be safer because they don't have the same risk of causing permanent movement disorders, but they do have some risk of that. They also cause agitation, severe weight gain, diabetes, hyperlipidemia. They put you at risk for early heart attacks. And again, diabetes is particularly important in Vietnam veterans because if they were exposed to Agent Orange, they're already at a hugely increased risk of diabetes. So just to summarize, most of these drugs are dangerous. They're ineffective. There is good evidence from multiple sources that medical marijuana is an effective treatment for some of the most important symptoms of PTSD. And I hope you'll recommend that this bill go forward with a favorable recommendation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Questions? Thank you very, very much for coming all the way from Coos Bay driving. The next panel is Michael Krawitz from Alexandria, Virginia, and is he on the phone? And then Judy Gregg, Jose Garza, and Anthony Taylor. Do we need to call Michael Krawitz?
Matt and Karen, we're calling him right now.
Okay.
so he should be momentarily.
Okay. So it is 4:15. I plan to stay, individually, I don't know my colleagues, are for everyone to testify. But the panels that we're having now had let us know that they were coming, and so that's why I'm giving them more time. Please proceed, whoever's going to go first.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Anthony Taylor, and I'm one of the directors of Political Action Committee, Compassionate Oregon. We are trying to get Michael on the phone right now, and I believe we'll be successful at that here in the next minute or two. I am going to defer my testimony till the end, and let's start with Jose, if that would be all right with the chair.
Please do.
And then come to Judy, and then hopefully by that time Michael will be on the phone.
So I...
Please introduce yourself.
I'm Jose Garza. I do got to apologize. I'm real shaky, so my voice might be a little shaky. I've been asked to come and speak to you today as a veteran who suffers from PTSD and who uses medical marijuana to help control it. You might ask why I don't seek other forms of help. I have actively sought help and have been given limited amounts of visits and medications that don't work. As we all know, mental health services for veterans are limited and inadequate at best. It is well known that in the veteran community that we can expect to receive little to no help. Veterans who survive wounds, explosions, and other events may suffer PTSD, but so do many others who do not receive any physical injuries, and the majority are undiagnosed. PTSD is a ticking time bomb. For example, I'm sure you've all heard of the recent stories of the combat veteran who shot a top sniper, taking his life. He had been diagnosed with PTSD and seen several times with no real help given. He had threatened to harm himself and others repeatedly, and eventually he did. Please remember that this man, who willingly laid his life down for his country, gave all he had and more, and he just exploded. We say, I support the troops, but we don't really, do we? You don't know or understand or even understand why or even know how they can react so strongly when, say, a car backfires, or why they can't go into places with a lot of people, like a grocery store or a manufacturing plant. It's because those things make us anxious, edgy, and hypervigilant. It affects our ability to hold down a job and function in society. We get angry. We get confused. We get scared. We have seen things no person should have to see. Friends torn in half, brothers dying in our arms. The fact is, you can feel safe when you walk down the street without worrying if the next car is going to explode. It's because of a veteran. You see the news, we lived it. We have been exhausted, hurt, scared out of our minds for months on end. Not every veteran has taken a life, but every one of them would be willing to give theirs. And we get no support when we get back home to deal with it. We weren't even diagnosed until recently. PTSD is one of the largest problems facing veterans. For some, it is a death sentence. Many will turn to substance abuse. They will cling to narcotic painkillers, alcohol, cocaine, and meth. Many will begin a lifelong downward spiral that they never recover from. As a combat veteran, much of this is my own story. After my anger got the best of me in the military, my civilian life began. I started my downward spiral. I was in and out of jail. I started going from one friend's couch to the local bridge, back on another couch. I tried to get help and still today am denied services. I started getting into large amounts of trouble and I got my first felony. I wrecked a motorcycle in a high-speed chase. So I moved back to Oregon and tried to start new here. But my anger issues would not let me keep a job, and I began getting into trouble once again. My motivation for life declined. I had attempted suicide several times. I was just a shell of a man at this point. I had lived 25 years and was praying for the release of death. One day I met a childhood friend. She saw how much of a mess I was. She saw my anger was uncontrolled and my hostility was going through the roof. She then convinced me to take a look at marijuana. I began smoking. Slowly I calmed down. Slowly I was able to find ways to cope with my past. Slowly I could go back to the grocery store and not completely freak out. Now I'm able to go into a store and be okay. I'm not great, but I believe in myself now. As some of you may know, I had an incident a number of months ago. I was chased. My fear was debilitating. My rage took over. My military training kicked in, and I attacked. I had not consumed marijuana in several days. I lost control, and I paid the price. These incidents are few and far between for me now. As I have said before, I am not great, but I believe in myself now. The simple act of smoking a plant has changed my life. Medical marijuana is just that. Medical. Medicine. It has helped me to cope, to learn to control, to not be so afraid. It calms me. The Veterans Administration did nothing to help me. Mother Nature did. I'm not a hippie. I'm not a stoner. I am not a criminal. I'm a United States veteran, and this is what has saved my life. I urge you to consider this, please.
Thank you very much, and thank you so much for coming. Thank you for your service, and I am very glad that you have been able to find something that will give you hope in life. Questions, comments? Now, I do believe that Michael Krawitz, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Would you please introduce yourself, tell us who you are, and proceed with your testimony?
Yes, thank you. My name is Michael Krawitz, the Executive Director of Veterans for Medical Cannabis Access. We are a national veterans advocacy organization, and I am based in Virginia. I really appreciate your taking the time to consider this bill and take testimony today, and thank you for taking this telephone testimony. I'll be kind of brief and allow you to hear, hopefully, from others on the floor. First, I'd like to point out that you've heard some testimony about the use of the currently accepted treatments by the FDA for post-traumatic stress. Those two medicines that are approved right now are Seroquel and Risperdal, I believe, is the two. And the report of the Surgeon General of the Army recently had quite a bit to say about these medications, that the medications were not useful enough against the side effects, and that the problems with these medications were outweighing the benefits. I refer you to the Army Surgeon General memo of April 2012. It's a very significant document that goes into quite a bit of the medications that are available, not just the two that are FDA approved, but the other ones that you've heard of as well that are commonly used, benzodiazepines and others, and they're all extremely problematic and not particularly positive for the veterans. And again, we do have many of these medications have a side effect warning of the risk of suicide right from the medicine itself, which is aggravating the risk of suicide already inherent in the brain injury we call post-traumatic stress. And I want to point out that this is a brain injury. This isn't a failing of the individual. This isn't something that can be counseled away by looking into your youthful history, as psychiatry is used to taking care of disorders. This is actually a physiological response to a very serious input that just can't be partitioned off anywhere else in the brain. That it doesn't happen to every vet is a problem. If it happened to every single vet, then we wouldn't be calling it disorder, and we wouldn't be dealing with it this way. I think it's a big problem because it creates stigma that prevents people from seeking treatment. There's a big problem now in the Veterans Affairs to get veterans to come in to seek treatment. And I'm hoping, and my colleagues are hoping, that your addition of post-traumatic stress to the Medical Marijuana Act out in Oregon will help reduce some of that stigma and allow the veterans to see that, indeed, cannabis is not that dangerous for vets. I mean, think about how you would internalize that right now. If you can access cannabis for pain, but you can't access it for post-traumatic stress, I mean, somehow the veteran's going to internalize that they're somehow not eligible for treatment, that, you know, they don't deserve treatment, that the treatment isn't, the post-traumatic stress is too scary to be treated with cannabis. There's a lot of ways that you can internalize that, and they're all problematic. We need veterans to be able to feel free to come in and see treatment. And I'll finish up by just saying that we did succeed in passing Veterans Affairs policy that allows veterans to use medical marijuana in the state program. The Veterans Affairs has its hands tied by the DEA. They can't allow the veteran the access themselves, and they can't write the recommendation themselves, but they have carved out an exception for veterans to use cannabis, and they rely on the state. So the state really has the ball here, and the Veterans Affairs is hoping, beyond hope, that you can pick up that ball for our veterans, for their care. Once you do, then the veteran can go to the VA and get counseled and get additional advice on how to use cannabis and how it's effective. But the VA really can't initiate that conversation without your help. So I'm definitely available if you have any questions of me on the VA policy or on the use of, you know, cannabis in general for post-traumatic stress. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much for participating. Any questions? Thank you. Judy.
Did you want to? No, go ahead. Okay. Thank you. My name is Judy Gregg. I'm from Eugene. I gave the clerk copies of a study from a Congressional Research Service dated February 14th. This is just for your information. It's not what I wanted to talk about. But there is one part of it I would like to mention. In the research, they found that there's 1.6 million people from the Iraqi-Afghani wars with PTSD. And 22 of them commit suicide each day. I'm a former state commander for the Vietnam Veterans of America. I am a veteran. And a former Veterans Service representative for Lane County. I was going to speak on behalf of the veterans with PTSD, but I see a lot of people are. And I started thinking about where I work and some of the people there that use medical marijuana for their PTSD. Brian Michaels talked about the people with PTSD that are violent for no reason and have all these different problems. And that's where I work. I work at St. Vincent de Paul Eugene Service Station. It's a day center for homeless and low-income people. We have washers and dryers. We feed them 2 meals a day, a couple snacks. We show a movie in the afternoon. It's a safe place for people to be. We have such a small area for people to gather. We have about 200 people a day that come. And it's a small area, you know, and there's a lot of fights. But I've noticed that the people that use medical marijuana really aren't the ones that are fighting. I've spoken with several of our clients just very recently when I learned about this hearing, veterans and civilians, in the past few days, and I'd like to be able to represent them. Everyone I've spoken with tells me about how it keeps them a lot calmer in their thoughts and their nerves so they can cope with their day-to-day life. So many of them with the PTSD, they can't hold a job down. They have no income. They have to live on the streets. And then they're living on the streets and they can't afford to get their card and they can't afford the medicine, you know? And so a lot of them, unfortunately, are using it illegally. But they have to. Another one of our clients told me about his PTSD. He was ministering in the park where Occupy was. And they started yelling at him, "Get out of here, Jesus freak," and horrible obscenities to them. And they forced him down to the ground. They fought him, and they broke his leg. And, you know, he can't afford medicine for his pain and for his PTSD. Really like for you to consider, please, SB 281, help these people out, everybody. Like, Brian Michaels just hit it on the head, and Jose, you have too.
Thank you. Question? Anthony.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. Members of the committee, thanks for having this hearing today. As I said earlier, my name is Anthony Taylor, and I'm a director of Compassionate Oregon. I'm also a veteran. Today you have seen a great deal of scientific evidence that shows seen and heard, and I know you received a lot of information on this electronically, but shows that cannabis to be an effective tool in the management, treatment of symptoms relating to post-traumatic stress disorder. And you've also been given an insight into the current process for adding qualifying conditions to the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program and why we feel it is necessary for you to make this change. A couple of things I would like to add. As I've gone from office to office meeting with the members of this committee, I've noticed copies of the magazine Veterans Benefits set out so people can pick one up, and I did. And much to my surprise, on page 14, there was an article entitled Trauma and PTSD. I thought this to be very timely. It is a short article on common physical, mental, emotional, and behavioral reaction associated with the disorder, and it also provides a link to the VA's PTSD page. If you go to the link, there's a discussion about medications used in treatment of this disorder, and many have spoke about that already today, but the medications that are known as SSRIs, or selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, such as Prozac, Paxil, and Zoloft, while often effective in treating depression at a certain level, are often associated with increased anxiety and depression. We are reminded of this every time we hear a TV ad and the advertising disclaimers which caution that use of these medications may lead to thoughts of suicide. When used in conjunction with other medications to treat PTSD, these problems can be exacerbated. There are in excess of 100,000 deaths every year from the prescription drugs in the United States. To date, there are no studies linking these cocktails that the veterans are given to the high rate of suicide among service members, but it certainly warrants further study. The evidence you've heard today also offers insight into why we are convinced cannabis can be helpful. You've also seen evidence as to the Department of Veterans Affairs and their easing policy around its use. We are also beginning to see these changes at a state level. The Oregon State Board of Pharmacy has recognized the therapeutic value of cannabis and rescheduled it as a Schedule II controlled substance rather than the Schedule I status it maintains at the federal level, giving the state-level protection for those physicians that wish to use cannabis as part of an effective treatment program. The Oregon Pain Management Commission, in their position statement, advocates for patient access to marijuana for therapeutic purposes. They also conclude that numerous randomized clinical trials have demonstrated safety and efficacy in treating central and peripheral neuropathic pain. The OPMC also supports programs and funding for rigorous scientific evaluation of the potential therapeutic benefits of medical marijuana and the publications of such findings. In addition, they support increased research for conditions where the efficacy of marijuana has been established to determine optimal dosage and route of delivery. They go on to say that medical marijuana research should not only focus on determining drug efficacy, but also on determining efficacy in comparison with other available treatments. We should adopt this approach and add this condition to the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program as well. I provided all the members of the committee with this book, and when I went to get this, the person behind the counter got to talking, and she, of course, preparing this, knew the topic, so offered her own story. To make a long story short, her veteran husband returning with PTSD ended up in a divorce for the safety of the family and especially the daughter. She wished me good luck with this effort. As I said earlier, I am a veteran, and to be more specific, I am a Vietnam-era veteran, but I was lucky. I enlisted at the end of the war and was stateside my entire enlistment. And upon completion of my service, I took advantage of the GI Bill and attended college under the program. But over all these years, I've never really thought of myself, as a veteran, you know, with a capital V. And although I suited up for my country, I never had to pull a buddy out of a foxhole or pick up pieces after a mortar attack or claymore or an IED. I've never applied for health benefits or taken a home loan because I always thought, pardon me, there were other veterans that could use these benefits more than I could. And there is a common feeling among veterans that somehow they did not do enough for their fellow vets. Some call it guilt. I'm not sure about that, but what I am sure of is that I am, although shakily, able to stand up for my fellow vets on this issue. I ask the members of this committee to reflect on the message, having the Veteran Benefits Magazine available in your office sends the message that you are concerned for our vets and that you are willing to help, even if it is a tough call. Mental health care is a top priority in the discussions about gun violence these days, and Senator Courtney spoke just yesterday of the need to address the issue of mental health in a serious way. I ask you, when considering this bill, to remember that it's not about physical pain or about abuse of the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program. It is about mental health. It is about implementing a simple fix for a group of our fellow Oregonians, and not just the veterans, but others who suffer from the disorder on a daily basis, sometimes minute-to-minute basis. The medical marijuana community has been advocating this addition for over a decade. It is a treatment tool we should make available without further delay. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much for your heartfelt testimony comments. All right. Now, this was our scheduled people who have let us know before, a sort of scripted presentation. There are 17 other people left to testify, and I'm going to limit you to 3 minutes apiece. And I'm going to take those from Douglas County. I believe that is John Sapp, Vitor Power.
Sejo. And is this Voter Power?
Yes.
Voter Power. Oh, I saw. Okay.
And then Linda
Massey, do you live, where do you live?
Okay. Mary Hoke.
Mary Hoke, where do you live?
Medford,
Vermont. Would you please come up? And Cheryl Smith, where do you live?
Eugene.
And Jim Clark, where do you live?
Brookings.
Come up. We want to get those who live furthest away to testify first. And please, I don't know how to run this, so we run this. Please proceed.
My name is John Sager. I'm the director of Voter Power. We've advocated for the reform of marijuana laws for about 15 years. Chair Montes Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, I hope you're as persuaded and moved by the previous testimony as I am. I don't think I can add a whole lot. I guess I would just say that over the last years, I've worked with thousands of patients, helping them with the medical marijuana program, and have had the privilege to help a lot of people. One vet that I helped stands out in my mind because he was not a vet of Afghanistan or Iraq or Kosovo or Vietnam. He was a vet from World War II. And he told me that marijuana helped him with shell shock. And fortunately, he was able to overcome the stigma of using marijuana, which for someone of his generation was very difficult. And he told me about his veteran friends that that wouldn't use it because of the stigma. And I would just echo Mr. Kravitz's comments that, you know, when we have medical marijuana and you can get approved for severe pain, but you can't get approved for PTSD, that does keep some people out of the program, and I think that's very unfortunate. This vet from the World War II told me how the marijuana that I provided him enabled him to sleep at night and dramatically improved the quality of his life. And I just wonder, you know, how many people are missing out on the benefits of this medicine because of the stigma. And so I hope you'll take that into consideration and pass this bill.
Thank you very much for coming. Yes.
Hi, I'm Mary Hoke, and I'm from Southern Oregon Normal. My husband, William, served 3 tours in Vietnam and was awarded 2 Bronze Stars. We were married for 32 years, but Bill was afflicted with PTSD. Bill would jerk to wake several times a night, and he would check the perimeter and open all the doors and check all the locks, and repeatedly night after night. And the VA prescribed medication for this, and they said that he could not smoke marijuana. And so he quit smoking, and they prescribed medication. And I took a trip to Portland, and this medication was supposed to be working. And when I was gone, Bill had a flashback. Some young fellas, 3 or 4 on the motorcycles, pulled up in our yard, and Bill heard the motorcycles and thought that they were Viet Cong. And when the young man knocked on our door, Bill took his pistol and opened the door and fired a shot right past that kid's ear. And as he allowed the kid inside, and he did give him his pistol, and the kid called me, and I was up in Portland, many miles away. And the kid's voice was just shaking, and he was very upset. And I had my daughter and family to go and see if they couldn't sort the situation out. And they got the kid on his way and got his gas, and they got Bill to smoke some marijuana because he had not received, because I was not at home, and he was on this thing with the VA of not smoking. But they had him smoke some marijuana and got him calmed down again, and got the young fella on his way, and it ended without a tragedy. I don't know how. Sometimes when things would be burning in our fireplace, Bill would get a flashback and get agitated and start crying and be unable to control himself in any way. And I would give him a pipe with cannabis in it, and it would help him to click back into life and start up again and not be out of control. Even my young son, grandson Justin, knew how it helped his grandpa. When things would get out of control, he would come wake me out of a sleep to tell me grandpa needed his special medicine because he was really, really upset. And my grandson does not smoke marijuana at this time, and he has never tried marijuana, and he's 24 years old. So it has not enticed him to smoke. but he knew it helped his grandpa in a way that was very, very important.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Co-Chair, and the rest of the esteemed panel, my name is Jim Klar. I have been on the Advisory Committee to Medical Marijuana since its inception, serving two terms as chair and presently vice chair, and also started one of the largest groups in the state called Oregon Green Free, where only registered users of the program can be. I'm going to make this short because I just want to tell you about one instance, because Lee Berger and everybody put it pretty well about how the federal government and NIDA is stifling the way that we do research. Right here in the state of Oregon, we were discussing with the program the ability to send out a survey to everybody in 2009, and we were told, well, if you could find somebody to fund it, we'd be more than happy to do it. A group from Berkeley with a Dr. Reinman and us all met up at Portland State University, who agreed to put it out. All they wanted to do was dovetail it, like, say, in a OMMP mailer. Didn't have anything that was against HIPAA, but it would have told us more about things like secondary conditions and stuff like that. On our website, we've always run polls, and here recently, the interim head of the OMMP, Jody Noon, asked me to put one up that was about the change in prices, the fees, and what it was doing to people. But I know that's not of concern here. But we've always ran one, or have for quite a while, about secondary conditions, because it would ask people, are you using cannabis for your primary, or is your primary condition what you're using it for? Is it really your secondary? And over 50% at every time we've run that poll, it was saying it was their secondary condition, and they were using their primary was not their main concern. So Oregon's been really great. We're blessed to have this program, and we need to stay ahead and make this right for everybody, particularly, and not only vets, but anybody who has PTSD.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming. I think it's Jerry Wall, I'm not sure, Wade, and Stormy Ray, and Seth Grant.
I'm representing Stormy Ray.
Oh, are you? Okay. So Seth Grant, and then Richard Connolly. Go ahead.
Good morning. My name is Jerry, or afternoon, I guess. My name is Jerry Wade, and I'm with the Stormy Ray Cardholders Foundation. As many of you probably know, Stormy was the chief petitioner that began Oregon's medical marijuana program with ballot measure 67 in 1998. In 2005, the Stormy Ray Foundation, working with the Oregon State Police, and I have to put a shout out to Senator Cruz, who co-sponsored that bill, we were able to make significant improvements to our program. Stormy asked me to personally apologize that she couldn't be here today, but living across the state, it wasn't possible. Stormy sat on both of the previous health department advisory committees that were looking at adding PTSD over the last 10, 12 years, and she voted in both cases to add PTSD as a qualifying condition, seeing the need of this drug for people with this illness. As a service-connected disabled vet myself, I would like to personally thank this committee for taking up this important issue that has affected so many of our veterans returning home. And I want to go off script a little bit here because I, as a disabled vet, I have gone through the Veterans Administration Hospital in Portland now for 13 years. And out of those 13 years, my primary care provider and my pulmonologist, which is the head of pulmonology for both the VA and the medical school there, has supported my use of medical marijuana. But the VA itself has blocked their doctors from being able to help patients actually get into this program. A letter that came out in January 31st, 2011, specifically acknowledges our program and that our it is, that they cannot block other pain medications or they're not supposed to, but it prohibits the doctors from signing the return letter that comes from the health department acknowledging that they actually wrote into the chart notes that they support the patient's use of medical marijuana, and which inevitably blocks the patient from using that recommendation to get their card. And these are state-registered, licensed doctors in the state of Oregon that under Oregon law are being permitted from returning a letter to the health department, another state agency, verifying that medical records are correct. And I think that is outrageous. That our this is a policy issue. This is not law. This is strictly the Portland, the head of the Portland VA's policy that they came up with that says that he will block doctors that support medical marijuana from helping patients that are veterans, and that needs to change also. And I, again, the only other issue that I really want to point out again is that you all need to take another look at court docket 8622 that was Honorable Francis Young through the DEA that basically, again, really emphasizes the safety of this drug. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
My name is Richard Connolly. I'm a disabled vet, too. I'm a retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel, fighter pilot. I flew 204 missions over there. And I came back with PTSD, and marijuana helped me out. If you're an officer and a fighter pilot in the Air Force, you get a few special things, like Air Force flight surgeon telling you that, hey, it's marijuana that will fix you. And I even got an assignment to a place where I'd be able to get it, and that was before the government was paranoid about it. Okay. Having said that, I've also counseled PTSD victims. I was asked to do that, and I was able to make it through 46 of them, but I'm not strong enough a person to do that anymore. There are things that humans should not see, feel, or experience, and they leave stress. And having said that, this is not about vets. This is about stress caused by trauma. And we don't mention a class of people, of victims. It's far greater than vets. Mm-hmm. And these are the most important people in our society, our women and our young women, young girls. I'm a grower, and I have a patient who has PTSD. From being repeatedly raped until she was 16 years old. And this kind of trauma, I will advance to our senators, has much longer effects on our society, bad effects, than the PTSD that comes back with our vets. Our vets, who are the real victims, either commit suicide or get themselves locked up. I know one personally who don't know what caused it except that somebody blocked his access to his little kid. And so he used a .44 caliber revolver to open a door, and he's now in Huntsville prison in Texas, and he'll stay that way. But it's our women who are the most important victims of this particular kind of stress, post-traumatic stress disorder. I speak for vets. But I'm also a person whose my recovery was a little bit delayed because I lost my wife, and she left me with four little babies. Ages were 2, 3, 4, and 6. And so I came through that. But I appreciate what it is to be both mother and father. And for our culture, for our state, we need to protect everyone who suffers from post-traumatic stress disorder. And as you've heard in abundance, marijuana is the medication for it. That's thank all you. I have. Thank you very much, Senator. Thank you for giving us PAs and nurse practitioners. Oh. They are, for me and my wife, they're far better than doctors. Thank you.
All right, next.
I'm Seth Grant. I will echo the very last statement that the previous speaker made, in that I think we can see that there is an astronomical percentage in medical malpractice fatalities per year than there are in cannabis. And leading this conversation, I'll open it with that. Thank you, committee, for hearing this. I was a military medic for 15 years. I served several deployments doing civil disaster relief as well as a combat mission in downtown Baghdad during OIF-2. If you're not familiar with the chronology of events, that's when IEDs got popular and foreign insurgency, so my business was good. I got out after coming back from Katrina, where I patrolled the lower Ninth Ward for a solid month as part of a reconnaissance outfit. Our specific task was to go into the lower Ninth to identify where bodies were, where homes were, and where things needed to take place from there. I worked in emergency departments in the Portland area for nearly 20 years in level one trauma. Suffice to say, I've seen my share of broken people. That's not what I carry with me in PTSD. That's not what affects me. What affects me today is what I attribute to a combat environment. But I attribute it to a combat environment because of the duration of exposure and because of serial studies that have looked at not only neurophysiological findings by MRI, in that continued chronic exposure attributes to a physical change in neurochemistry. Much like the previous speaker spoke about with respect to victims of sexual assault, I would also include those who have been exposed to a combat environment for any period of time or any stressful situation. Those things cause an absolute change in the prefrontal cortex, which is our filter ability to not have that knee-jerk reaction. With Senator Shields, your background in seeking community health care, Senator Cruz, you have a very outright spoken desire in American freedoms. The chair, you're a nurse, particularly with background in substance abuse, breast cancer awareness. You certainly can't be unaware of the benefits of cannabinoids in cancer research. And Senator Cobb, as one of the forefront in gun rights and gun control, I'm certainly you can appreciate the SSRIs versus the OFMP with respect to knee-jerk reaction with folks that are being treated their post-traumatic stress disorder with drugs like Zoloft, with drugs like Effexor, that I'm on, that I'm tired of being on, and I am now weaning off with the help of my VA psychiatrist. What I do is I maintain through medical cannabis. My wife will know, I'm sorry I'm over time, within 6 hours, have you smoked? My knee-jerk reaction to anything inflammatory, defensive, is one of 0 to 60, and that is the consensus that I see through PTSD victims, and that is what's truly mitigated by the chronic use and maintaining that therapeutic balance of tetrahydroxycarbinol in their system. There is no question that it has significant benefit on that PTSD reaction.
Thank you very much. All right. Mark Wilson, Charles Greg Beebe, and Jared Townsend, W. Townsend.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I want to apologize to those who haven't spoke. I have a 5 o'clock meeting I cannot miss, so I apologize for having to leave.
But before you leave, would you do this?
Okay,
I would like to recess.
Nope. I'm just going to gavel out of the public
hearing. Okay, I'm going to just temporarily gavel out of the public hearing of Senate Bill 281.
Great. Okay, then.
And open a
work session.
Work session.
Madam Chair, I move that we suspend the rules for the purpose of letting Senator Shields vote on Senate Bill 166.
Senator Cruz moves to suspend the rules for the purpose of letting Senator Shields vote on Senate Bill 166. Is there any opposition?
I'm still thinking about it.
Seeing none, no strong opposition.
Senator Shields.
My thanks to the committee. I vote aye.
So Senator Shields votes aye on Senate Bill 166.
Okay,
with that, I would like to close the work session on Senate Bill 166 and reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 4281. Now proceed.
My name is Mark Wilson, and I'm from Forest Grove. I currently am a cardholder, so this doesn't really matter to me, the outcome of it, but I've also been diagnosed 3 times with PTSD. As recently as last year, I left Providence. I went through all the pills and all that stuff. I detoxed, threw up 10% of my body weight, and went from the hospital only smoking and taking oxycodone because I have chronic pain. I went through the summer, did pretty well, decided that I would, with my wife, that I would join a counseling group at Pacific University for aftercare. As I started to prepare for this aftercare that started when school started in the fall, I stopped my marijuana use so that I would enter this study cleanly so that I would know, you know, what was going on. They put me on medication, which was medication I had to choose. I was uninsured, so I was paying for this program myself out of my own pocket. I chose Effexor, took Effexor, and tried to function normally, and I was being followed weekly by the clinician at Pacific University. After a while, I started to see improvement, but I just could not move. I just couldn't get up and get out of bed. My wife suggested that I resume smoking. I got out of bed, and I functioned well. Then there are part of our plan that we had was to eliminate the marijuana and the opiate drugs, if I could. So I went through this program. We decided with a nurse practitioner I would take a different drug that would help with nerve pain and stuff like that, and I would take and stop the marijuana use. This was on the 15th of January of this year. So I did that. I stopped marijuana use. I took the pills. I did exactly what they told me. I went downhill fast. I mean, as fast as anybody could imagine. On the 21st, I found myself in the Tillamook State Forest. I took 66 Ativans, and I don't know how many Vicodins or whatever. Anyway, I crashed so hard, and it was unbelievable what happened to me. I went through the state hospital, the humiliation of all of this stuff. I had to take a bus from Eugene back to my home, light rail. I went in scrubs. It was awful. And when I got to the bus station in Portland, I met with my caregiver. He took care of me. He supplied me with my stuff. He got me on the right train home. He followed me on his bicycle, and I made it home. And now I'm just fine. I've been out of the hospital 1 week. By all means, I shouldn't even be sitting here talking to you. I shouldn't even be sitting here talking to you. But, you know, I was fortunate enough that I fell out in the snow and two loggers found me, or I'd be dead right now. It doesn't matter to me what happens because it doesn't affect me, but please, there are other people out there that need this.
Thank you
really
very
do.
Much. Thank you. Next.
Charles Greg Beebe from Silverton, Oregon. I'd like to add my testimony to with the other veterans. I was in Vietnam in 69, 70, 71, and 72. And the only reason that I'm alive is because of marijuana. I became a patient because of a service-connected disability in 1999. One of the other side benefits from being a service-connected pain, service-connected for pain that I've found, is that medical marijuana alleviates PTSD symptoms. For example, flashbacks, being able to sleep at night. And when I have war dreams about Vietnam, it helps me level out, get back to sleep, and become more of a human being again. So I'd like to just wrap this up by letting you know that medical marijuana, as far as post-traumatic stress disorder for combat veterans, works, and little from the Veterans Administration has ever worked. I get a little bit of counseling, and I get Prozac. That's all I've gotten since 1972, and the only reason that I'm alive today is because of marijuana, medical or otherwise. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Jared Townsend. I've been in the Army for 8 years now. I had an Iraq deployment. I was a scout gunner. I performed over 164 missions. I'm not going to get into details of what happened because I saw plenty of combat. I've held friends while they've died. And today I'm here for five men that can't. And two of them were suicides. They took Ambien, which was prescribed by the VA, and they drank and they died. The other three died in car accidents from drinking and driving. I started using medical marijuana after I almost committed suicide myself, and I talked to a close friend that I had deployed with, and he recommended hitting the peace pipe. And ever since I hit that, I've been able to function and return back to a normal life. I had my child taken away from me for 6 months for violence in the home. I broke my hand and punched a door in front of her. I was drunk. I passed out, blacked out, shot my gun off in town. I hope you guys don't know what happens when you were sleeping, but it happened. And I couldn't sleep, and so I couldn't figure it out. So I started smoking medical marijuana. I'll be graduating with my bachelor's degree in real estate finance. I have over a $100,000 job now, and I'm starting to make it, and none of it was from the VA. The VA has killed my friends and caused more problems than I'd like to talk about, and one of my reasons for almost committing suicide was not getting help that I needed from the VA. I've been waiting for medical discharge in the Oregon National Guard for 4.5 years now, and frankly, my family needs insurance, and it's not me. It's the other people that have cancer and can't get help and are still working in $100,000 in debt because the military will not take responsibility for it. So I'm here for my friends today that cannot talk, and I hope that you add this to your bill.
Thank you, and thank you for your service, and congratulations on...
I also had four other friends that were supposed to come today, but they're afraid to talk. So there's a large population out there that isn't coming forward.
Thank you very much. Comments? Thank you very, very much. Did we have Jim Krieg?
He had the...
Okay, Reverend Will I. Amwinget, Linda Massey, and Dan Kuser. Go ahead.
Hello. I've been here before. I'm really grateful for...
Say your name for the record.
My name is Reverend Will Wingate, and I am Senior Minister of the Church of the Caring in Eugene, Oregon. I really appreciate you all being here and working through this. I know it's been long. I'll keep my comments brief, but I've heard so much today that actually gives me hope. The fact that you're actually listening to these doctors who are taking this stance and talking to you about all the things that have frustrated me for 30 years. Because the biggest problem for me is the fact that you don't believe me. You know, as a doctor and as a congressperson, I've been trying to get you to use marijuana. I stayed outside your building here for 40 days and 40 nights, just trying to get the government to listen to the fact that we could have been making money this whole time. Since Dave Frohmeyer and Barbara Roberts were in office, that's when I was here. And I've asked them why they didn't care enough to listen to what we're saying as vets, because we have vets in jails, and we have vets who are dying. And it's because we have a belief that we'll be listened to. But when we came out of the Vietnam War and found that we lost the war, that we were never supposed to win, how are we supposed to trust you? You know, understand that. That for me, I walk down the street and I take care of people. I take care of all the people that all the organizations here, at least in Eugene, talk about taking care of legally. I take care of them illegally because they won't come in here. They won't go to a clinic. They don't trust the doctors. They don't trust you. The man was just here. He's here representing four people. I'm representing hundreds that I take care of on a daily basis. I have to deal with stress every day from the police, from people on the streets who want to rip me off and steal from me. And yet, understand, I don't have my children in my presence, because when I lived here in Salem, I had a SWAT team at my door with their guns drawn and masks on them. I went to the door naked. And I told them, you are putting my children at risk. You're allowing cigarettes to be smoked on the streets because you can't stop it. It's too big. Just like the gun lobby that he was talking about. They don't want their guns being taken away. Understand, we have always been courteous with you and listened. And as many times as we've explained this over and over, because this isn't the first time these things have been said to this Congress. And yet, for us to have to fight for something as simple, we had to fight for Agent Orange to be recognized. We had to fight for PTSD to be recognized. Understand, please, when you say you care, make it so.
Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Linda Massey. And I'm here as a cardholder. I'm here as a mother of two vets, one who is diagnosed with PTSD, who I was a care provider for several years, who I had begged the VA to take care of, who turned on me as a result of not getting care. And I am now homeless as a result of it. I have now been diagnosed with PTSD from my vet son who has PTSD. And I'm here as a homeless person to represent all the homeless people and many other family members who are being diagnosed with PTSD as a result of their family member. We need that help desperately. I have seen so much, and I'm an advocate with the NAMI, National Alliance on Mental Illness. I've seen so much out there. I'm fortunate in that I'm able to be a cardholder, but there are so many homeless people desperately need that and are not able to get some help. And that would make a difference in their lives.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I'm Dan Kuser. I'm the director of the Lamont Valley Normal. That's the Eugene chapter of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. My testimony will be very short. I see Senator Cruz left. I wanted to address him as well as every member on this panel. I hope that you will pass this on to him. I have one request. I would like to see the legislature do something for the patients instead of something to the patients. Last year, they did something, the legislature did something to the patients. They doubled their fees, which caused extreme hardship on a lot of patients that I work with. A lot of patients have dropped out of the program and now probably are going to be subject to law enforcement. So I say, please do something for the patients by passing this on as a pass, recommending to pass it on favorably. And that's the end of my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for coming, all of you. With that, I would like to call Jim Krieg. Did he come back in?
No.
Pardon?
He's gone?
He's been gone.
Okay, he'll pass. Then we have Cheryl Smith and Anthony Johnson and Reed Smith. And I believe those are the last three. Did I miss anyone?
That are signed up.
Okay. Please proceed.
My name is Reed Smith. I pray that you hear this with your hearts. I know no other way than to deliver it with steel. I'm self-diagnosed with PTSD. I'm treating it myself. I have my Oregon card. It cost me 90 Vicodin. I was getting those for pain from my primary care doctor. The medical marijuana does not take care of the pain. I grit my teeth, I grind my teeth, and I wouldn't trade it for nothing. The difference between my PTSD and the pain is worthwhile. Yes, I would like to take care of the pain. But between the choice, there is no choice. It is so much easier to deal with the world, with the public, on an even keel, this way, with the Vicodin. I can't deal with the world. It treats the pain, yes, but it doesn't treat my head. It doesn't deal with my head so that I can deal with the people, deal with the public. And there's no other way to put it. There really isn't. Please hear that with your hearts. That's all there is to it. I have a friend, and he can't come up here because he's got to stay anonymous because of his job. He's been given prescription medication to attempt to deal with his PTSD, and it's proved overpowering. It's proved not to do it doesn't work for him. It doesn't work right. It messes him up. He's not a cigarette smoker. He's not a pot smoker. But he doesn't have the option of attempting to use the medical marijuana in foodstuffs in other ways that it can be used as an attempt. He doesn't have the option of trying it in a safe fashion. And this, we're not trying to get to anybody to smoke this. We're trying to give people options. That's all we're trying to do.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Anthony Johnson. I am Executive Director of the National Cannabis Coalition. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm so grateful for you to seriously consider Senate Bill 1081. I moved to Oregon in 2004 after graduating from law school and practiced criminal defense for 2 years with Leland Berger. I've worked for Voter Power, I've worked for Oregon Green Free, and I've worked in medical marijuana clinics and spoken with countless patients who have utilized medical cannabis for their PTSD symptoms. And you've heard from veterans today, you've heard from medical professionals, and you're going to be getting getting more and more, you know, testimonials and emails and phone calls from medical professionals and veterans and other people suffering from severe trauma. And I hope you seriously consider to pass this out of your committee. This problem can seem so insurmountable. It brings in all kinds of aspects of our government and criminal law, mental health in this society, FDA, NIDA, the roadblocks to research, Pentagon policy, Veterans Affairs, and it can seem just like a huge problem, but you have an opportunity to do something really special. You can really help people in this state, veterans coming back from war, other people suffering from severe trauma, and you can really improve people's livelihoods and even save some lives. So I really encourage you to pass this bill. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And I think we have everyone. I want to make sure that we had everything. Everyone, any comments? All right, come up. You have 3 minutes.
While she's coming up.
Yes.
Could I just tell everybody out here that I'm just really impressed that all of you came and told some really heart-wrenching stories. On Saturday, I'm going to a funeral in Springfield for a friend of the family who served honorably in Operation Enduring Freedom and had a very bad PTSD episode and ended up getting hurt and recently passed away from that. I hope we'll consider this bill strongly, and I would be in favor of moving it on with a due pass recommendation when the time comes for that, Madam Chair, when you're ready. I know we're not moving it today, but I do want to thank all of you for coming, and your testimony was very persuasive.
Thank you.
My name's Eva Morley, and when my son came back from Iraq, we went up to the VA, and they diagnosed him with post-traumatic stress. And we didn't know anything about post-traumatic stress, so my husband and I got on the computer. We learned what we could. And I told my husband, I said, Lloyd, this is you. When he was in the military, when he was in the Navy in Australia, he drowned, and luckily they saved him. But the man that left for his drill was not the same man that came home. And I knew that, and I tried to point that out to him, and I would say, I'm going to call the military and tell them I want my old guy back. And he would say, you're not going to ruin my military career. And then when my son came home, and he took my husband to the VA, and he was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress. Since then, he started smoking marijuana, and it has helped. And we see my son, who is on these terrible pills, and the pills have changed his personality, and he can't sleep at night. And he's just not the same person that left before Iraq. And then I saw my son-in-law, who is really high up in the military. He went to Iraq and he went to Afghanistan. And during that time, my daughter begged him not to go because he didn't have to go. You've already been there. And when he ended up coming home, and we could see that he had post-traumatic stress, but would not say that he did, has never asked for help. They got a divorce. Now my grandkids live some at his house, some at our daughter's house, and I've seen that it ruined a family. If only they could discover marijuana. My son says that he can't do that because he has to have he has to work. And if they do a drug test, then it would show that it would come out on the drug test. And my son-in-law, he's against marijuana. He doesn't know that it's medicine. And it is. And I ask you, yes, help the veterans by passing this. But help the families. Because the families, we're the ones that have to watch our loved ones suffer with PTSD. And it is forever. And we suffer with it every day.
Thank you so much for sharing your story. Yes.
I'm the victim of which she speaks.
Okay.
I'm retired military. I have been disabled from drowning and reserve of our wonderful Portland unit.
You would need, if you want to speak, you need to come up and introduce yourself.
I'll be short and quick.
I've been through
Say your name.
Lloyd G. Morley, Jr. I'm a retired Navy enlisted guy of our local mobile inshore underwater warfare unit. I drowned in Australia, dead. I'm back here on this planet, not the same place. Marijuana is the only medicine I've had that can alleviate the symptoms without having severe side effects, like I'd like to wake up this week for a little while, or I'd like to go to sleep this week for a little while. I fought for all our civil rights. I ain't going to give up mine for medicine that works for me. And so please, please, and also straighten out the federal government while we're at it. We are the bellwether states.
Get them on the phone.
Let them get the picture.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I really did learn a lot, really good information and a lot of good stories. So I think the one more person that wants to testify.
Well, it's not 5:30 yet. If I could have another minute.
Oh, no, you already testified. This was supposed to be over at 4:45, so we've stayed over. So thank you very much, everyone. And with that, we're adjourned.